morning, friends. It's Friday with Jim here on Coast Community Radio, and I am your host, Jim Wilkins. And that's the reason we named it Friday with Jim. I'm fortunate to have with us this morning a couple of visitors from Fort Clatsop, Jill Harding, who is the Chief of Visitor Services, and Kathy Peterson, who I've known for years, who works out there as the Parks Education Coordinator. Thank you both for being with us.
Thanks, Jim.
Friday with Jim is conceived originally by Lisa Smith. I don't know if you know Lisa, but she conned me into doing this program many years ago, and I've been intermittently doing it ever since. Thank you, Lisa, if you're around so much. And Friday with Jim is produced by Kathleen Morgane. And also, we're happy to have us back in the studio after a brief absence, our engineer par excellence, Mr. Terry Wilson. Terry, thank you for being with us. So getting back to our visitors, I wonder if we could start out, Kathy, with just a kind of a brief biographical sketch of Kathy Peterson and tell us a little bit where you came from and what you do.
Okay, thanks, Jim. I moved to the area with my husband in the early 90s as a reporter for the Daily Historian, and it was my first daily reporting job out of graduate school from University of Oregon. Gradually segued over to some freelance writing work. I wrote a garden column for years for the paper in the garden. And then as we have two children, and I did a lot more freelance writing and got involved with the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial in Oregon to raise money and work with Senator Betsy Johnson's group to help promote and put on the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial, and met some great people at the park, developed an interest in youth programming through work with the Astoria Children's Museum, and kind of put it all together and applied for work with the Park Service to become an education ranger. So my job involves going out with school children and connecting them to the park. We see about 9,000 students a year at Lewis and Clark for education, and then have also helped to write programs for school children and work with other rangers that are providing education.
Yeah, cool. Jill Harding, how about you?
I grew up in the Northwest, went to Washington State University and graduated in natural resources. And that led me to Astoria and getting a seasonal job at Fort Clatsop. And I was seasonal work there till about 95, got on as a permanent ranger. And then in 2002, became the Chief of Visitor Services out there. And so basically I've spent most of my national park career down here at Lewis and Clark. I have a son, and he's 12 years old now, and just been loving it and living it down here.
Very good. I wonder maybe, Joe, if you could talk a little bit about the history of Fort Clatsop. When did it come into existence? And I know over the years it's grown, and maybe you could describe how that came about.
I've been very privileged to work at Lewis and Clark. It's a little bit different from other national parks because it is a community-oriented park. In 1955, when the first fort was built, it was built by the community, and then it was given to the Park Service in 58, and that's when it became Fort Clatsop National Memorial. And it was just 125 acres just around the little fort. With the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial in 2003 to 2007, the community rallied and said they wanted to see more sites set aside about the Lewis and Clark expedition. So it became Lewis and Clark National Historical Park in 2004. And then the park began to include 1,500 acres in Oregon and then another 1,500 acres in Washington. So it includes the Fort Clatsop site still. That's the heart of the park. We have the Fort Clatsop Trail, which is 6.5 miles from the fort all the way out to the ocean to Sunset Beach. The Salt Work site down in Seaside, which actually was incorporated into the park in the 70s. And then across the river, we have the Middle Village Station Camp, which is by McGowan and surrounds the St. Mary's Church out there. And then Dismal Niche, which is a rest stop right now. And then Cape Disappointment has federal land that was originally Bureau of Land Management land that was transferred over to the Park Service. So it's Park Service land, but it's still managed by Washington State Park as Cape Disappointment, Washington State Park.
Now, you mentioned Dismal Niche, and you said it's a rest area right now, which to me implies that you've got plans for changing over there.
There is some plans in the work of working with the folks over in Washington, Department of Transportation, of kind of revamping the site, putting in some interpretive works, and making it a little bit more park-like versus a transportation rest stop. And it has an incredible story of transportation from the expedition coming through, from being a ferry site, and then all the natural resources, such as the salmon impact over in that site.
So that was that location was where the Astoria Megler Ferry docked on the Washington side?
That is correct, yes.
Oh, okay. So it's been years since that ferry existed, but I remember riding on it.
Yeah.
Well, Kathy Peterson, education coordinator, you've got some interesting programs coming up this summer. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what you got going on out there.
Sure. We're doing a real summer of engagement with folks of all ages. And kind of first off, and starting Monday, we've got the first of our youth camps going on. It's a nature adventure camp for youth between about 9 and 12 years of age, 4th, 5th, and 6th graders. We've still got a couple openings, so if people are interested in having their children have a great day camp experience with an overnight in the fort, which we don't tend to do that often with groups. So it's pretty fun.
Oh, so the kids will stay overnight?
We do. We do one overnight sleep out in the fort. And I can verify that it's a pretty amazing event to wake up right there. Then we have a middle school age survival camp that'll take place the next week, July 20th through the 24th. And we're teaching youth basic skills so that if they were ever in a situation that they needed to take care of themselves while they're out in nature, or you know, in a situation that they needed to rely on some of their basic smarts.
Middle age survival camp?
Not middle age, but middle school age.
Oh, middle school.
Yes,
okay.
I'm middle age survival camp. Yeah, I'm still working that one out myself. And we've got a really wonderful crew of summer employees that have come on either through our Youth Conservation Corps program. We are employing four high school and first starting out in college age youth to get experiences with each of the divisions in the park, and that's called the YCC program. And as well, we have two interns through Latino Heritage Initiative. One's a Healthy Parks intern looking to get people engaged with the park as a place to go and be healthy, to do our trails, to take our paddling trips. And then we have another intern who is looking at creating some Spanish language programs, some hikes, some paddles, and he is starting to do kind of his first interpretive programs these past 2 weeks. Other things coming up this summer for visitors that we're excited about, it is the National Park Service birthday, 99th birthday on August 22nd, and kind of the kickoff to our centennial, which is a 100th year anniversary for the entire Park Service. So we'll be inviting folks to come out August 22nd and help us celebrate. We've got our salt making activity will be August 15th at Avenue U in Seaside, the Salt Works. And we've got a couple of experiences coming up in September we're really excited about. One is a Sunday in the Park with Art on September 20th, which will involve kind of a amazing experience on the Cuis Cuis Trail with local artists and musicians, and a chance to kind of see that trail in new light. Finally, we have a run, the Scramble, but this year we're pairing up with Providence Hospital from Seaside to do a Scramble to Outpace Diabetes. That'll be on September 26th. So we're really looking at doing some new engagement and getting really good results. We were just down at the River People's Market last night. Oh. I was down with a couple of rangers, and we've been at the Sunday Market, and we'll continue to do that in Astoria throughout the summer.
Yeah, that was kind of my next question is what, and you addressed it just briefly there, but What kind of outreach programs do you have to get yourself out into the community besides the farmers market?
Well, we, speaking, you know, from education, we do a lot of classroom visits, either engaging kids before they come to the park, so kind of prepping them for an experience with us at the park, or, for instance, we have a program that Ranger Tom Wilson has developed, and he's a retired Astor elementary school teacher. He, and Lewis and Clark elementary school teacher, he brings a Newfoundland dog to the students, and he dresses up and in costume and reads to the kids and kind of shares the message that it's pretty cool to be able to read and then to read your dog or your cat or your pets. So we have a lot of education outreach that way. In terms of community outreach, like I said, we're really trying to hit a lot of community events this summer and hope to continue that through the fall. We have, I would say, and Jill, check me, but I would say that our trail use has really expanded. We have upwards of 15 miles of trails now that have been developed in the park, and we have there's an informal walking club and trail use club, the Lewis and Clark Trail Club, I believe is their name, and folks are regularly out kind of enjoying and exploring. And we're heartily encouraging that for people to come by, buy their Louis Pass, their $10 a year Louis Pass, and get a trail map and go out and enjoy the trails.
Cool. You know, Jill, a good friend of mine used to be the director out at Fort Clatsop, Cindy Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
And Cindy has since moved to the Big Island of Hawaii and is, as far as I know, I haven't heard from her in a couple of years, but I think she's still working for the Park Service as the director over there.
She is the superintendent of Hawaii Volcanoes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is kind of an exciting position to be in, considering that the volcano is very active.
Yes.
But I'm wondering if you could, Jill, describe the basic national structure of the Park Service and, you know, how many national parks are there? And in your situation, is it likely that you're going to transfer to other parks and move about?
There are 407.
Seven.
We keep adding them, which is great. So 407 national park sites now. Yes, usually when you're in the Park Service, to move up, you have to move around. I'm one of those strange people that was able to stay and move up within the park because the park is changing. The Park Service encompasses anywhere from what you think of the big iconic parks as the national parks, Crater Lake, Yellowstone, Yosemite, Glacier, to national historical sites like Lewis and Clark historical parks like Lewis and Clark or historical sites like Fort Vancouver, to urban parks like Golden Gate, National and Scenic Rivers.
Seashores.
I have to think of all of them. It's in the Park Service also administers the National Register. And so a lot of sites around, a lot of homes around Astoria are actually
Historic Registered.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's quite big and quite encompassing. I mean, you have small parks from just one house like Martin Luther King's home to big national parks that cover acres and acres like Glacier National Park.
Yeah, you mentioned that the park is changing.
Mm-hmm.
Describe those changes. What are you talking about?
Kathy mentioned some of it is our focus. I mean, we're still based in Lewis and Clark. They're still our heart story, our main story. We still have the folks down at the fort in costume giving different talks and demonstration. But on top of that, we've really tried to branch out and promote recreation. And a lot of how I see our little park is introducing visitors to recreation and opportunities that are in and available on your other public land. So, for example, we have a kayaking tour and canoeing tour that we do, and it's kind of just get out on the Little Luce and Clark River, go for a three-hour paddle, see if you like doing that kind of recreation, and then maybe go and explore on your own some other styles of kayaking or canoeing or water activities. We have 15 miles of trails. Come out, walk, nice, easy trails. They're not your wilderness experience, but they get you out into the woods, get you walking, get you back to nature, and allows you to experience that. And then you can decide whether you want to head to some of the bigger national parks and go for a more longer, strenuous, and maybe take on a wilderness hike in the future. So it's in the Park Service, you have urban parks like Golden Gate, where you're in the downtown San Francisco. And then you have your big parks like Yosemite and Yellowstone that have these huge wildernesses. And we're kind of this park in between that can help you get you out of the city, but it's doesn't quite have that wilderness experience, but that's good. So if you want to get a little bit used to nature and before you decide what you really want to do.
Yeah, great. Time to remind our listeners that it's Friday with Jim here at Coast Community Radio. We're visiting with Jill Harding and Kathy Peterson from Fort Clatsop National Park. Now, one thing I'm curious about, Jill, what kind of budget do you have to deal with out at Fort Clatsop?
The budget this year, we always have to watch our budget. We've been fortunate in the past with the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial that we got a little boost in our budget. But things, like anywhere, you have to watch it and keep everything balanced. So we try and we go for soft money, what they call soft money, and our fees really help us put money back into taking care of our trails and making more trails. And allow us to hire crews such as our youth crews to come out and provide them opportunities to work in a national park and to build trails for the community.
Well, I'm sure that our listeners are probably as curious as I am. Could you speak in specific dollar amounts?
The actual amount of what our budget is?
Yes. Is it secret?
No, it's not. I just can't remember it. I know what our that's funny.
Well, a certain amount of it comes from fees and right. And that you collect from people that are visiting, and a certain amount of it is provided by the National Park Service.
Yes.
Any idea how those balance together?
Well, our fees, the amount that we collect in fees is a little over $100,000. And so it is, and then our budget is a little bit over $1 million for the whole park. I don't know the exact. we have 14 permanent staff in the park. And then in the summertime, we have that usually doubles in the summertime for seasonals and youth crews. So with that money, we service about a quarter of a million visitors to the park and provide education programs for over 8,000 students.
So. The fee money that we collect, it's just really important to note that that money is directly put back into services that serve the public.
Sure.
That's the responsibility we have with all the budget for the park, but particularly fee money needs to go toward things that make the visitor experience positive. Those can include restroom updates, which are vitally important, accessibility improvements at the park, and giving youth a chance to work and look at park experience is one thing. Those youth also work very hard. They will go in and learn how to do building maintenance. They come in and they work in interpretation. But any of those recreation dollars are kind of directly seen again by the public.
You know, it seems like a lot of your programs are kind of fun-to-do type activities, but yet when Lewis and Clark were here, it was the opposite of fun to do. They had a miserable time, and they were cold and wet, and insects were biting them, and they couldn't get enough to eat. How do you convey to visitors how miserable it was for those poor guys?
It's hard to do that in the summertime, especially on a summer like we've had today, because it is dry and beautiful, and the guys who are down at the fort are usually starting to melt in the buckskins because they get pretty hot. But they do a really good job when they're down there of talking about how miserable the expedition really was, how much it rained while they were here at Fort Clatsop. They were here for 106 days. They saw the sun only six, and they had rain, no rain 12 days. So it was clearer, no rain. So they work really hard to try and explain how miserable the expedition was, what kind of elk they were eating, and that's basically the only thing they had to survive off of. And the elk was winter elk, so it was very poor. And it comes pretty clear through the journals. I mean, almost every entry in the journal talks about rained as usual, nothing worthy of notice. So they were waiting, counting their days to be able to leave. But another thing we often talk about at the fort is that if it was not for the rain, we wouldn't know as much about the expedition as we do, because they were stuck inside. They had to get their homework done, and they got their journals all caught up. So when you read the journals, there's a lot of entries in there that talk about different parts of the country that they saw. So they're getting it all caught up and letting us know in the future here what they actually saw on the expedition.
My impression with the whole idea of how miserable it was is that people will often, visitors will kind of check their own experience against what we're presenting, or that, you know, they're gathering from the journals or maybe readings or stories of the Clatsop people who were there. And I think that whole theme of survival and teamwork and kind of self-awareness really resonates. I, again, kind of speaking from working with youth, Survivor Man and Man versus Wild and Naked and Afraid, I mean, all those kind of public, those TV shows and those ideas, I've been doing this for a while, and now I can hike with kids on the Fort Dixie Trail, and we'll know the same episode of Man versus Wild, where he skins a rattlesnake and uses it to carry water, the skin, you know, and mm-hmm. the kids will be just engaged with that idea. So there's a lot of, I think the Lewis and Clark story holds a lot of really interesting meaning for people who are thinking now about kind of getting back to just themselves and maybe being in nature that way. But yeah, the summer visitor, that doesn't quite resonate, probably how miserable it was.
You know, somebody that I've spoken with on this program and elsewhere is Rex Zeke. Mm-hmm. Have you worked with Rex?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's an amazing guy, and he's very knowledgeable about the Lewis and Clark. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about your interrelationship with Rex and his knowledge?
I have had interaction with him when I was a reporter for the Daily Historian,
right.
Just also know him in passing as very learned and devoted to researching the story there. I think it's great to have ideas out there about what's gone on.
And he's had kind of a different interpretation of some of the journals that as opposed to the common acceptance of what the journals say. I'm not sure of that difference. Do you know anything about it?
He's done a lot of work of bringing to light the stops on the Washington side,
right.
and where they were and interpreting that site. He's an incredible storyteller.
Yeah, he is.
And very passionate about it. And it's really fun when you're working with the Lewis and Clark story to meet all these historians that are so passionate, whether they're professional historians or amateur or just starting, of how passionate they are about the story And, you know, any time when people can get in and dig into the minutiae of the journals, it's just, and bring a light, the human story, it's fascinating, it's wonderful.
Yeah, it's pretty cool that, 200-year-plus old writing is still engendering, like, a really fresh discussion.
Well, he was able to, on the Washington side, he was able to go through the journals and actually recreate where the expedition went, actually, where they walked, where they camped. And there was some question about some of the campsites, I understand, but he was very fastidious in his research.
Yeah. And we get a lot of historians doing the same thing, and as a Park Service, we love to hear all the ideas and all the stories that people interpret from the journals and through history.
Is there some way that those interpretations are recorded and available to the visitors, or that's just
different people's writings or considerations about it?
Yeah.
We have a research library at the park that folks are able by appointment to come in and see, you know, published materials. Jill, I know that people come and do talks and several of Rex's other books that I've written, we've got
those
available.
Where are the actual physical journals?
The actual physical journals are in Philadelphia in the Philosophical Society Museum.
Okay.
And the maps are at Yale in the Beneke Library.
Can people go access them if they want?
You can. The Beneke Library is public, just like any research library. You know, you have to make an appointment and go down and access them. And some of them are actually online. The journals themselves, you can sometimes get in with appointment, and sometimes they're on public display. They're a little bit smaller society museum. But all the journals are online, are typeset and produced online. And
have you actually physically seen the journals?
Not the journals.
I think that would be fascinating.
Would be, you know, yeah.
I haven't seen the journals. When I was back in the area, they were getting ready and prepped to go for the bicentennial on a display, but I've seen the maps, and they're incredible. They're really neat to see.
We'll be having a scholar in residence this summer, Gary Moulton,
thank you,
who helped really bring the journals to public understanding and has a great version of them. So we'll be announcing some events with him. He's going to be with us this summer.
He'll be giving a talk over in Washington, down in Seaside, and then also at the Fort Clatsop Visitor Center this summer.
Okay. Well, we've got just a couple of minutes left. I'm wondering whether you might have some specific things that you'd like to tell people about in the next couple of minutes.
Sure. The Park Service will celebrate its centennial in 2016, 100th year anniversary of the founding of the actual service. And I think it's a great time for people to come out and explore parks and engage with parks and really take advantage of everything that their parks have to offer them. We tell school children, you know, these are your places. And we look forward to having, a next generation of park visitors and park employees and park ownership. It's kind of the best of what we have, I think, as American people.
All right, Kathy, you got a little end note for us?
Me or Jill?
Excuse me, Jill.
Oh.
Centennial.
Yeah, basically the centennial is to build on what Kathy said. The parks belong to the people, and Fort Clatsop or Lewis and Clark National Historical Park is a prime example. It was started by the folks in the community, and it's your park.
Yeah, the story of the community jumping in was exciting. I remember when it happened.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Well, I really appreciate both of you coming in and visiting with us. It's been, for me at least, a fascinating discussion and a reminder of some part of our history that sometimes passes people by. Kathy Peterson and Jill Harding, both from Fort Clatsop, have been with us, and I'd urge our listeners to stick around, because next on Coast Community Radio following the news will be Albert Smith and his always wonderful Friday Folk Show. And I, God willing, will be here next Friday at 9:30 for Friday with Jim, and I invite you to join me. Thank you.